Through this series, we've heard how history leaves fingerprints on every stage of a life. From pregnancy to childhood, from education to work, from joy to grief. And today, we close with what endures, what we pass on, what we choose to carry, and what we refuse to let follow us into the future. The cycle of inequality in America, from slavery to segregation to mass incarceration, didn't just shape systems. It shaped identity. It shaped who felt worthy of opportunity and who had to fight for it again and again. But legacy is more than struggle. It's the pride we inherit, the traditions we protect, the stories we pass on. And for Kenneth and Sharon Holly, longtime entrepreneurs, culture keepers, and owners of Zawadi Books on Jefferson Avenue in Buffalo, legacy is something you build every day.
You start with your family, you do something small maybe. Maybe you start a bookstore. But then you give it to the community. And finally, the legacy comes when it picks up in your culture.
Throughout this Truth Be Told podcast, we explore personal stories of racial inequity across the lifespan. I'm your host, Will Green. And today, in our final episode, we explore legacy, what we inherit, what we preserve, and what we choose to hand forward.
Everybody has a story, and it's important that everybody knows how to tell their story. So for me, as a storyteller, I think it's important that we're able to pass on through oral tradition those things that were important to us.
Before we begin, a poem.
The Baton of Legacy by Dallas Taylor. Your name enters the room before you do. Legacy is what's left behind when you walk out. You are called to be remembered through action. That's when existence outpaces essence. What you dream becomes a foreshadow and an answer to a problem. Without legacy, the future has no leg to stand on. It wobbles like uncertainty and diminishes in value. But with polish and strong foundation, a tabled yesterday gains legs for tomorrow. When those legs gain speed and life finds its track, legacy passes the baton so purpose can finish what was started.
For the Hollies, legacy is a long table, and generations before them built its legs.
How y'all doing today?
Oh, doing pretty good.
Sunshine's out, doing good.
Sunshine is out. It's a beautiful day, right?
Yes, it is. I'll
tell you what, it's a beautiful day to talk about legacy, right?
All right.
Okay. If you walk into Zawadi Books today, you'll find shelves curated with intention. African diasporic history, children's books filled with Black joy, and stories that tell the truth, even when the truth is hard. That curation started long before the Hollies ever opened their doors. It started in childhood.
Growing up, education was very important. Reading was always stressed. So I was read to at a very young age by both parents who felt that reading was important. And growing up for birthdays, special occasions, I was given books. So that was the importance of having the books. So I had books of my own. And I always tell people my story of my comic book library, because I loved comic books as a young child. And I had every comic book you could think of, especially fond of Archie, Veronica, Lulu, you know, but I like Green Lantern and some of the other superheroes too. But that library allowed me to read the books in my comic book library and loan them out to everybody in the neighborhood who didn't have a comic book library so that they could read.
A little girl running her own library, checking out books, collecting overdue ones, long before she ever imagined becoming a librarian. At a time when Black children often had fewer books at home, a documented disparity that persists today, Sharon created access for a whole neighborhood. For Kenneth, legacy came through a different door.
My father was a dock worker during that time, and the men in the community all came out of these factories. And you see him come home with this soot and everything on their outfits, but they wouldn't go home. Now, my father used to come home on Thursday night because that was his last night. He worked overnight. And him and his friends would come to the house, and they would sit there and they'd make themselves the biggest breakfast I've ever seen in my life. Eggs, bacon, sausage, pancakes, and they sit there and eat and drink. And one of the things they always did for my mother was, they always say, Ruth was my mother's name, what books did you bring me? Mm. And I thought this was fascinating to me. Because here were these men coming home from work, start going home and get some sleep. They come here and eat and talk about what books they wanted. Now, what my mother would do, she'd go to Goodwill. And the Goodwill at that time had these big bins of books. And you could buy them for 5 cents, 2 cents even sometime. And she'd buy all these action-packed books for my father. You know, it'd be on sports or mysteries, whatever. And these men would come over. When they go home, they always say, Ruth, can I take a book? You know? So all of them would take a, most of them would want to take a book home with them. And that fascinated, these men would be so interested in books. And matter of fact, that fascinated me is why. Mm. So I wanted to go in there and get some of these books and see what the heck they were reading.
Right.
Men coming home from the factory covered in soot, stopping not to sleep, but to talk about books, to choose new ones, to argue about mysteries and sports novels. This is Legacy 2, quiet scenes of literacy and community that rarely make headlines, but shape a child's sense of what matters.
So it's like a tool for community building, right? And a specific purpose behind connecting over the books. I think also for you, Miss Holly, that family input, bring you the books. You had your own library even yes. back then.
Yes.
So it's funny, you mentioned you would get gifts as books, right?
Exactly.
In my family, I give out books as gifts and people don't seem very happy.
Well, things are changing a little bit because in our household now, grandchildren get books. Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, Grandma, do we have to get another book? Yes. But we're building, helping them to build their libraries. And I understand they go through a phase where they're not really interested, as one of the older grandchildren will say, I have to read all day in school. Right. I don't want you giving me books. But we want them to, trying to encourage them to read not just the school book, but to read for pleasure.
I just got to say another thing that we celebrate Kwanzaa. And during the Kwanzaa celebration, on the sixth night, you give away gifts. And one of the gifts that's always suggested that you should give is a book. So our children and our grandchildren all celebrate Kwanzaa. And they all know, no matter how much the grandchildren moan and groan, that they're going to get a book mm-hmm. on that Kwanzaa night.
Mm-hmm. What's the significance of the name of the bookstore? Isn't that connected to Kwanzaa?
Well, it's actually, Zawadi means gift.
Yes.
So it's a Swahili word for gift. And when Dr. Karenga created the holiday Kwanzaa, he used the language of Kiswahili mm-hmm. in naming the seven principles and naming some of the things that take place. And one of the symbols of Kwanzaa is Zawadi, which is gift.
Okay.
Joy is a form of resistance. And the Hollies inherited that joy from elders who insisted on dignity even within segregation. Especially in a generation coming out of Jim Crow, Florida, where libraries, schools, and even bookstores were segregated, and opportunities were rationed by race.
My mother did graduate from high school. My father did not. He went as far as eighth grade, but he valued education and he valued books. Now, ironically, they did not have a library of books in the house. You know, they had, of course, the Bible.
Yes.
My dad had different interests, so he had a lot of photography magazines. Or my mom, everybody had Ebony Jet, you know, when that yeah. came out, mm-hmm. that you would read. But they didn't have a so-called library, per se. But they valued education, they valued reading. And it might be because they might not have had a chance to pursue it as much as they right. wanted to pursue it in their lifetime, that they push it on to the next generation.
And that value for education set the Hollies on a path that would eventually lead to one of Buffalo's most important cultural institutions.
So when did you guys open up the bookstore?
Well, two things happened in 1976, mm-hmm. 49 years ago. One, we started the bookstore up on Main and Michigan. And the other one's we got married that same year. So the bookstore is 49 years. We've been married for 49 years. Mm-hmm. And what we did before then, we collected books, each of us had our own books. Mm-hmm. And we'll find out we had duplicates. You know, we had two of a lot of things. So we started collecting books for the bookstore at that time in 1976. And then when we moved up to Maine in Utica, we had a collection of books of our own that we could just put in the bookstore.
Harambe Books, now Zawadi, began as a single wall of books in their home. Two young book lovers who kept buying duplicates, just in case they didn't stay together.
Before we started, we would go to bookstores. So we would go to bookstores looking for particular kinds of books. In Buffalo, there was a store downtown that was part of Ulbricht's, I think. Mm-hmm. And they had a small section of books and a smaller section of books by black people.
Right.
And it was mostly the street books. There was a big African-American store in Toronto. We would go there to that store. There were some bigger stores throughout the country that we could go to. And we knew some of the publishers of the smaller books, Broadside Press, Dudley Randall in Detroit. In Chicago, there was Third World Books with Haki Madhubuti.
Yes.
In New Orleans, there was Kalamu Ya Salaam with Ahidiana Books. And in New York City, there was The East. So we were making contact with all of these people about the books that they were publishing too at the same time.
But still, they dreamed bigger. They imagined a bookstore for Buffalo's black community, a place where people could learn, debate, organize, imagine. Yet, when they went to officials for help...
I recall one incident. I think we went to... It was Small Business Association, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. It was somewhere when we talked about, because we weren't business people. Mm-hmm. You know, we were in the arts and culture and other things. And they looked at us like we were crazy talking about opening up a black bookstore. The feeling I got from them was almost a question like, why you want to do that? Black people don't read.
Ooh, we.
Mm. You know, that was, it didn't come out and say it, but that was... the feeling that you got sitting there.
That was the
energy. I think he was saying, you need $500,000.
In other words, don't be asking us for any money.
And their experience wasn't unusual. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, black entrepreneurs faced higher loan denial rates from the Small Business Administration, even when they had similar credit profiles, a practice that restricted wealth building for generations.
Black bookstores was a scene of many other things, like out of Zawadi and Harambe became, the Kwanzaa Committee started in that bookstore. Mm. The Marcus Garvey Day Committee started in that bookstore. Mm. The Malcolm X Day Committee, all of them started in the bookstore. Mm. We had the means there, we planned it there, we informed a little parade that we had for Marcus Garvey Day. We actually marched down Fillmore Avenue with our leader doing a New Orleans little march in front of us.
Right.
So these bookstores are no much more than just bookstores. They're a place to come. And some people came in just to read and talk.
Right.
They didn't buy books, but they came and read and talk, you know. And they might stay an hour and then put the book back and say, see you next week, you know. But the bookstore was known for a lot of things in the community.
Zawadi became a hub, a crossroads of ideas, movements, and histories, a place where people with different ideologies could show up, speak their truth, and be heard.
When we talked about your parents and why they had this love of books when they even didn't have libraries at that point, and it could have been because of these historical ways to keep black folks away from reading and away from books. And now you talk about the bookstore being a place that people from the community come and have these conversations, where you talk about a community that when you went into the business association to get a loan, they looked at you like you were crazy to talk about black folks with books.
Right.
So it becomes a hub of the community. I mean, where else could people talk about these ideas outside of the bookstore? Is that related to just the inequities within the black community in Buffalo?
I think people look for a place to have comfortable conversations. Mm-hmm. So even today, we have people coming to the bookstore with different ideologies that they want to explain to us or tell us their train of thought. And someone could come in right after them with a whole different ideology than the one that was just talked about 10 minutes ago. And sometimes if they converge on each other, there might be conversation, but not in anger, right. You know, not in protest. It's just some people say, I just had to get this out,
yeah.
You know, and this might be a place where I can get it out and not be judged.
One thing we got to remember, we got to go back in our history, because I was looking at some historical films during Black History Month. And the thing that amazed me was that we were the only people who could be killed for picking up a book. Mm. And these scenes were so powerful to me when I saw, especially like a teenage boy getting caught in his master's library, you know. And he wasn't reading it, but he was just picking up, looking at it. And he was wondering what was inside of it. His master came in and actually almost killed him by whipping him so much for picking up a book. Mm. We got to remember, we were the only people punished for reading. We were killed for reading, but we kept reading. Somehow we snuck, and we picked up the book, and we read it. We learned how to read. We learned, taught each other how to read. We taught people who would give us a little knowledge about this letter and how these letters go together. Mm. You know. So when other people come to this country, I say, yes, you had a tough time, but please, I mean, you enslaved people. Not thinking of as human, not can pick up a book, being killed for picking up a book. There's no other experience like our experience in this country.
This is historical fact. Under slavery, many states imposed laws prohibiting enslaved people from learning to read, punishable by brutal violence or death. Literacy, for Black Americans, has always been an act of liberation. Even after emancipation, Black literacy was met with resistance, from underfunded schools to segregated public libraries that limited access to books or barred Black patrons entirely. And Sharon saw echoes of Southern segregation when she moved north.
In the South, it was more overt. Mm. You know, things were like in your face. I grew up in a town that was segregated, or they say separate but equal, but never equal. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there were Black people lived in particular parts of the town, and the majority of people in the town, especially women, were domestic workers. I mean, they worked in houses of whites doing cooking and cleaning, and the majority of men did labor. It was very kind of rare to see, say, a man in an office unless he worked for himself. So the independent people in the community were teachers. If you had an education, you could go to school and become a teacher. That was the profession.
Yes.
Maybe you could work in an office. Maybe. Not generally. But if you were a hairdresser, you had your own independence, your own independent business. Or if you were an undertaker, you had your independent business. Or my uncle had a dry cleaning business, you know, so he had his own independent business. And these businesses catered to the Black community.
Right.
You know, and they provided the services that were needed, you know, for the Black community. But when you come north, you would think, well, all that's over. You know, it's very different. But when you get here and you look around and you see, well, it's different, but it's still the same. You know, mm-hmm. It's not as overt. Mm-hmm. But it's there.
Right.
You know, so it's like, stay in your place. You know, you can do this, but you can't do that. You can go here, but you can't go there. You can live here, but we don't want you living there. So it's the same kind of thing, but it wasn't the great big sign.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. It wasn't colored water, white water mm-hmm. when you got up here. It was just a fountain that you know you better not drink from.
Right.
Even mm-hmm. though the sign was missing.
These experiences sit inside a much larger pattern researchers call the racial wealth gap. Generations of exclusion, from slavery to redlining, blocked families from building assets that could be passed on. And while Black-owned businesses grew significantly in the last 5 years, they still make up just 3% of all U.S. firms in a country that is 14% Black. Today's inequalities aren't accidental, they're inherited. In Buffalo, the legacy is visible too. A 2021 study found that Black households in Buffalo held a median income less than half that of white households, a direct outcome of redlining and mid-century disinvestment. Zawadi Books is one of the exceptions and part of that long lineage. For the Hollies, legacy began with the gift of books, the fight for knowledge, and the desire to create a space where Black stories were centered, not erased. But legacy isn't just written. Sometimes it's spoken. Legacy doesn't live only on shelves. It also lives in voices, in the stories we tell. Because in many Black communities, the spoken word has always been the first archive, the place where memory survives even when records don't.
What does it mean to be able to tell your own story?
It's very important. I think, well, first of all, let me say everybody has a story. So the African-American story is not unique in the sense that it's the only story. All people, all humans have stories. So everybody has a story, and it's important that everybody knows how to tell their story. So for me, as a storyteller, I think it's important that we're able to pass on through oral tradition those things that were important to us. We mentioned books and we mentioned reading, and we are aware of not everybody's going to read, even though you want to make the availability of the books there. Mm-hmm. Some people respond and learn orally. And so using storytelling as a method to get information, to entertain, and to educate, you know, becomes very important.
Mm-hmm. So your love of books kind of brought you to becoming a librarian, right?
I would say that comic book library probably was a hint that I wanted to go into.
Well, yeah, you ran a library.
And she needed a job.
Right. Okay.
Sharon's path to librarianship wasn't accidental. It was foreshadowed in those comic book exchanges and neighborhood story circles.
When I moved from Florida to Buffalo, I was able to get a scholarship from the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library to go to library school. And part of that stipulation was that upon graduating, I would come back and have a job here. And so I did. And in those early years, first-year librarians were kind of steered toward being children's librarians. So the purpose was to begin to learn how to tell stories, be able to capture the interest of children telling stories. And you see how children react to telling stories. Storytelling involves imagination. Reading a book, and I used to use the example, I could read Little Red Riding Hood and show the pictures. And every child in there would say, oh, that's who Little Red Riding Hood looks like. Mm. But if I told you the story and you didn't see the pictures, she could look like anybody. She could look like you.
Right, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So you could imagine that Little Red Riding Hood could be an African-American girl. She didn't have to be what you just saw, that illustration on the book, because it kind of spurred the imagination. So storytelling had that appeal to be able to transfer these images, to be able to kind of spark the imagination of someone listening to a story without them seeing what everybody thinks it looks like.
Right, right. Right. So almost kind of constrained by the images.
Yes, yes.
Hmm. Okay.
So you were able to not only use a picture book that way, but to use historical references, biographies, and to be able to talk. And what I find is when people listen to stories, they kind of put themselves in the story.
They see in the Black tradition, storytelling reaches far beyond entertainment. It's identity work, memory work, community work. Its origins stretch back thousands of years. In West Africa, griots, master storytellers, carried the history, laws, genealogies, and wisdom of their people. They were living archives, holding centuries of knowledge in memory. That tradition survived enslavement, survived migration, survived erasure. When enslaved Africans were brought to the Americas, they carried that tradition with them, preserving history in the only way they could when reading and sometimes writing was forbidden.
Tell me about the griot.
You know, the griot was the man, usually an elder, who when their parents were letting their children follow their grandfather or some elder in the village, and they just follow him around and he'd tell them stories. He'd tell them where their great-grandfather came from. They might find a spot. They say, this is where your great-grandfather's first village was and things like that. And I was thinking about it, you know, down through the ages, we've always had griots. Yeah. The blues were a griot. Mm. You know, if you listen to Muddy Waters and them, they told you stories.
Yep.
You know, growing up in the 50s and 60s, late 50s, late 60s, I used to stand on hot summer nights listening to these men. And they'd be telling stories. They'd be lying, you know. They'd just be lying. I thought, they told the stories like they were true. Yeah. Everybody just sit around and laugh and listen to them. Listen to them for hours. And they could go on and on and on, you know, about. And that's the way you know, for the griot up to the present time with things like Sharon and Kareem Amin and other folks telling stories. You know, it's just passed down through the years.
Right.
And it wasn't always entertainment. Like, I always recall when Alex Haley first came out with Roots, and when he talked about how he was able to tell that story, it was by listening to the elders under the porch and hearing them talk about something and hearing the words of people he didn't know and didn't understand that piqued his interest to find out more about it. So the griots told stories that entertained people, but they were like the historians, the singers, the praise dancers, you know. They had a whole variety of things that they were able to do that was part of that village, that was part of that community. Mm. And that's been carried on, like kind of say, barbershops, beauty shops, under trees. You know, when I grew up, there used to be a group of men under a particular oak tree every Saturday.
What is the significance of the storytellers, the griots for Buffalo?
I think they're like culture keepers. Buffalo has its own collection of stories. I mean, we tell stories from the continent, and we tell the African folk tales, and we tell African American folk tales. But if you listen, Buffalo has its own stories. There are stories that people tell about Jefferson Avenue. Mm-hmm. That if you listen to them, it's like, it's not the Jefferson I knew. It's not the Jefferson that's there now. But they talk about this great street of Jefferson Avenue. It might not be as we remembered it. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about the businesses. Mm-hmm. And I do recall, you know, coming, you get on Jefferson and you smell them onions.
From Scotty's.
Exactly. Like you knew he was cooking by the time you got on that street, because you could smell them onions, you know, onions and the cheese. But people would talk about the businesses and what was going on in Jefferson and who came and who played at the clubs. And so each city, each place, you know, has its own stories.
It sounds like the stories are the individual people too, right?
Oh, we need the people to tell the story.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's three parts of storytelling, I always say. You got the story, the storyteller, and the listener.
Mm.
If you miss any one of those three parts, the storytelling's not working, okay? You don't have the story, then the listener and that doesn't work.
Yeah, the other thing about us, too, is that you mentioned Scotty's. If you go telling history, you start naming names, and telling the audience, people start shouting our names. Everybody wants somebody to be remembered.
They want to connect.
Yeah,
right?
They want to be connected to the story, right? Or they want somebody, their father, mother, somebody, a family member, to be connected to that story, that they're part of that story.
Right.
See, now, to me, this conversation that we're having really encapsulates legacy, because there's that connecting to the stories and naming these folks who are connected to it. The importance of Sankofa, this idea that we go back in history and we bring it forward for a purpose.
Right.
When I shout out Scotty's, I mean, the history of Scotty's, I think about John Young and black entrepreneurialism. what it mean to be on Jefferson at the time where we could circulate the black dollar.
Right.
Y'all getting me going.
In 1975, Karima Amin, a fellow storyteller, and I started a group here in Buffalo called Tradition Keepers, Black Storytellers of Western New York. And we were inspired by two people, really. Mother Mary Carter Smith of Baltimore and Mama Linda Goss of Philadelphia, who now lives in Baltimore, because they had founded the National Association of Black Storytellers.
Buffalo's storytellers joined a national movement, preserving black oral tradition, training new storytellers, and keeping history alive. And the stories they told weren't just folk tales. They were lessons.
We might tell a lot of animal stories. Well, you say, oh, what's a bruh rabbit? Well, once you start listening to the animal stories, you realize we're not really talking about animals. Mm-hmm. We're kind of talking about people. But they're like, everybody knows a bruh rabbit. You know, mm-hmm. somebody who's trying to get over. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the bruh rabbit stories were so significant because Brer Rabbit's not the biggest, he's not the strongest, but he uses his head. You know, mm-hmm. he's going to try to get out of whatever you put him in. And it reminds me of who our people are. We're not the biggest, the strongest, we don't have the most, but we're going to figure out a way.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of Brer Rabbit in us. Mm-hmm. to say, you're not going to trap me, I'm going to figure out how to get out of this. Okay.
The story behind the story. A survival manual disguised as a trickster tale. These moments, ordinary and sacred, are the threads of legacy. And when storytellers gather to name them aloud, that's when history becomes a living thing. This work is why Buffalo hosted the 42nd Annual National Association of Black Storytellers Festival, a celebration of culture passed mouth to ear, heart to heart. To understand where you're going, you have to know where you've been. For many black families in the U.S., tracing ancestry also means confronting gaps, missing records, erased names, and generations marked only by property rolls or bill of sale documents. For Sharon Holly, genealogy, the study of family history, is another form of storytelling, one grounded in names, documents, migrations, photographs, and memory.
I call it the study of family history. So genealogy is designed to help you go back and trace your relatives and your family as far back as you can. It's very interesting that the publication of Roots by Alex Haley really started a spurt in genealogy, because after that, people was wondering, well, where did I come from? You know, what are my roots? Genealogy was always there, but after Roots, it became really a hot topic for people to explore. So I dwelled into it maybe about 10, 15 years ago, trying to find out, you know, where my family was from, how we got to Florida.
Her search led her back to Abbeville, South Carolina, where her paternal great-grandfather lived before the family migrated to Florida, part of the long arc of Southern black movements across the early 1900s. It led her to journals her father kept, pieces of a history she didn't know she had. Kenneth's family history was full of Buffalo pride.
My Uncle Dan owned Dan Montgomery's down on Exchange Street. My other aunt owned Little Harlem.
Oh.
There in Buffalo. And they used to have all these famous people come in and out of there, you know, and they were all well known. Well, if you wanted to meet and greet people who were known in Buffalo, you go to places like Little Harlem.
Right.
Because everybody was there, all the politicians and everybody were there, you know.
Little Harlem, a legendary black nightclub where icons performed and community gathered. A place where black prosperity existed despite segregation. Sharon discovered whole books documenting black life in North Dakota and Minnesota, unexpected pockets of black migration. She learned that pictures, those fragile, curling, sepia-toned family photos are archives of their own.
Keep those pictures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you do, keep the pictures.
Yes.
Because if you want to grab people's attention, get them pictures. And what they'll do is they'll laugh at the old hairdos. They say, oh, God, this is the way they wore the hair, especially some of the men even, with their hairdos back in the 40s and 30s. You know, they had these crazy hairstyles, some of the men were. And go back and let them look at some of the dresses and where people lived, where their grandparents lived. And that really grabs their attention, even the small ones. Right. They want to know who that was.
Yeah.
Why did that person look so funny?
Right.
You know, things like that. So I encourage everybody to keep your old pictures where you can grab them and put them in a picture book.
Sharon's interest broadened from her own family to her entire community. She joined the Buffalo Genealogical Society of the African Diaspora, founded in the mid-1980s.
You just have to prove that your direct ancestor was enslaved. So it's for me, it was very gratifying because I was able to name, go back and name people, you know. These are my peeps, you know. It's like they have names now, you know. This is where they were, you know. So I think it's a really good way to reinforce your research.
We meet like once a month from September to May. We were meeting at the Meriwether Library. And it's just a place to encourage people to learn how to search on the internet and other forms to get family information, family history. And a couple of years ago, we put a book together called Kindred Stories, where members of the group were able to put a chapter in related to their genealogy.
Before we wrap up for today, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, in 2026, the Smith Center will be here in Buffalo for the community curation program through the Smithsonian. And we're going to have three genealogy workshops. And one topic is beginning genealogy. But Buffalo and the Great Migration, we're here because somebody came here. And we want to find out why. So, show of hands for people who think we should go with Buffalo and the Great Migration. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I think that's a majority, right?
Genealogy has often been harder for black families because federal, state, and local records frequently omitted or misclassified black individuals. The Buffalo group runs workshops for youth, churches, and community groups. They've launched the 20,000 by 2,000 project, collecting obituaries and funeral programs, transforming fragile, ephemeral documents into digital archives so families can reclaim their histories.
So we're still working on the fourth collection of our funeral programs. And I think once we do that, we should make a combined index for all four volumes.
Right.
And then if we put it online, then
And Sharon's work extends even further into the painful but necessary documentation of the 514 mass shooting.
We are in the process of getting together interviews of the community, people affected and people who lived in the neighborhood during 514, for them to be able to tell their stories, to find out how it affected them and how it affected their families.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of still part of that genealogy or history.
Right, and of course 514 being the racist, white supremacist shooting on Jefferson Avenue.
Right.
Genealogy is not just the past. It's the present and the responsibility to record it. Documenting 514 ensures that grief, resilience, and community response become part of the historical record. Not just a headline that fades. Tracing ancestry is powerful, but passing it on is the true legacy.
The genealogy doesn't stop. There's no end to it,
exactly.
Right? You can continue to trace it backwards, but there's also a pathway forward. What do your efforts look like to make sure that that legacy continues to be passed on to your future generations?
I think encouraging and introducing children to talk to the ones who are here. I mean, it's it's harder to go back when the people are deceased.
Right.
But if you live in the house mm-hmm. with an adult, you should be able to ask them some questions and talk to them. Even simple questions like, were you born here? Is that your real name? How did I get my name?
Right.
Where did we come from? You know, did we always live in Buffalo? Or if we did, where else did we live in Buffalo? Why did we choose Buffalo? You know, why? The simple questions that I think we can start to encourage our young people to ask people who are around them right now. Like, our greatest result as adults is, I wish I had talked to my mother. I wish I had talked to my father or my grandparent, and they're no longer here. Yeah. So you can't get that firsthand information. Mm-hmm. But to be able to tell children or young people, start where you are. Start in your house. You know, mm-hmm. Interview people in your house, you know, talk about that. Talk about your school experience. You know, how was it when you went to school? What classes did you like best? These are all the kind of things that create that family history that you'll be able to pass down.
Mm. I love that because I really think it brings home this notion of legacy, and it's connected in the stories. It's connected to the individuals. And by young people being the ones to engage with these folks while they're here, why grandma is here,
right?
While grandpa is here, we are almost contributing to them becoming the storytellers to pass on those traditions.
Right, exactly.
Family dinners, birthdays, graduations, every gathering is an opportunity to say, tell me where we're from. Studies show that young people who know their family history have stronger self-esteem and greater resilience because they understand they are part of a larger story. Without these stories, entire histories slip away. Even Kenneth and Sharon have spent years interviewing community elders.
Sharon and I, we got to, through WBLK and Freddie Patrick, we got to go out and interview different people in the neighborhood, in the community. Mostly people well-known, but some of them not so well-known. Yeah. And we'd tape them and do an oral history on them.
Yeah.
And then Freddie would give us a half hour mm-hmm. to go out and play these stories back into the community on WBLK. And we was always surprised about the response we got.
Any last thoughts on legacy?
There's something in Kwanzaa we say, family, community, and culture. Mm. And that means it starts basically with the family. If you can start with anything in your family and pass it down, and then you can give it to the community, then finally it becomes part of your culture. Mm. In other words, you start with your family, you do something small maybe. Maybe you start a bookstore. But then you give it to the community. And finally, the legacy comes when it picks up in your culture.
I love that. Yeah, I absolutely love that. Yeah. The power of the individual. Mm. Start with your family, then community, culture.
Right. It's impossible to organize a community if your house not in order. Mm. I don't care how powerful you are. You know, you can have all kind of big things going on, but if your house not in order, it doesn't work backwards. Mm. It really is. It starts family and then it goes up.
Legacy begins inside the home. Then it ripples outward, shaping identity long before any policy does. Legacy isn't something we leave behind when we're gone. It's something we build every day. In the Holly family story, we see how legacy grows from small acts. A parent sharing a book, a child running her own comic book library, a bookstore opening its doors for community and conversation. Their story reminds us that history lives in the ordinary, in kitchens and barbershops, in photo albums and family stories, and the people who make sure Black voices are heard and remembered. All of us have a role to play. Start at home, ask questions, save photos, record stories while the people who hold them are still here. In your community, support Black-owned businesses, cultural centers, and storytellers. And in our systems, advocate for policies that protect Black history and invest in the places where that history lives. Legacy begins with family, grows in community, and becomes culture. And every story we save strengthens the future we're building together.
So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, experiences, and your ideas and thoughts about legacy.
Thank you.
For 12 episodes, we've walked through a lifespan from birth to legacy. We've heard stories of struggle, perseverance, pride, and possibility. And every guest has shown us the same truth. Inequity is inherited, but so is resilience. Legacy is not just what we leave behind, it's what we nurture right now. I'm your host, Will Green. Thank you for listening to Truth Be Told, and for walking with us through a journey of understanding, reflection, and action. Truth Be Told is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media and Cruise Control Media in collaboration with Clementine Gold Group, LLC and WUFO.